All right. Hello, everybody. Welcome back to This Weird House. I am, as always, Nick Boddick, and today we have such a special guest. We have an actual legend in the house today. We have a guy who is batting 1,000 with his writing. We have a guy who literally every one of his stories that he's publicly released has been critically acclaimed and has been extremely influential on the genre. The progenitor of the creepypasta that has evolved over the years is this man, Ted the Caver himself, Mr. Ted Hegeman. How are you, Ted?
I'm doing well, Nick. How are you?
I'm doing good, man. I'm excited to talk to you again. We spoke for the first time, 5 years ago for my YouTube series, 100% True, which everyone should go check out, by the way. I could use the views. But yeah, it's just crazy how time flies. And I know we've talked a little bit over the years, but I'm really happy to get to have this conversation with you kind of again. We're going to go over a lot of the same stuff, but you just have such a cool story. And I'm very fascinated with the lore and stuff of internet horror and all that. And with you being the godfather of it all, it's a perfect guess. So I guess just broadly, the first question I would have is, tell us about Ted the Caver. How did it all come to pass?
This is kind of crazy because we talked 5 years ago and I'm coming up on 25 years when we first went in the cave.
That's wild.
That led to the story. So this December, so it was 1999, December, my buddy Brad and I wanted to get one more caving trip in for the year. So we set our sights for a cave. It goes by Freeway Cave or Interstate Cave because this whole caving system came to exist when they blasted out a mountain to put in Interstate 80, I-80, that runs across the whole country. So they discovered this caving system. So we had been out there numerous times, but we wanted to go out there this time to check out this one particular passage and see if we might be able to open it up and go through it. And obviously, it was about the size of your fist. There's the picture of it on the website. Just a tiny passage, and it blows cool air out. So always nice to stop and rest there and feel the cool air. So we went out there in December and determined that, we thought we could open it up and be the first people on Earth to go through this passage, which is a real cool idea for cavers. Always looking for that
sure.
Unknown cave or unknown passage. Even though caving in and of itself is just an adventure, anytime you go into a cave for the first time, it's still just a lot of fun.
Sorry to interject. When my fiance and I first got together years and years ago, I went with her family to Florida and I did all the stuff. We went to Universal. We went to here, we went to there. The one thing I could not do because it just terrified me was they went on this, it wasn't like a real in-depth caving spelunking expedition or anything, but it was just going into a cave. And I was like, I can't do it.
It was a commercial cave?
I think so. Yeah, I'm pretty sure. Yeah, it had a guide and everything. And it was like a thing. I literally waited in the car while they did it. It was 4 hours or something, but it wasn't a whole huge to do, but even still, just the idea of being trapped down, within a cave, no thank you, I can't do it.
There are different levels of claustrophobia, and that's probably on one extreme.
Yeah.
I have the other extreme of incredibly tight spaces, but we'll talk about that in a few minutes. But yeah, so we determined, we should be able to open up that passage. We didn't have any tools or anything to do it then. But we just started going back out there on a regular basis. And I think it took us 3 or 4 months, just going out there repeatedly and just slowly chipping away, literally, at this opening until it was big enough to go through. And finally was able to make it through there, and which was an unbelievable experience for me because first of all, it was so insanely tight that it took a lot of self-talk to get myself through that passage.
I imagine. That's quite the undertaking.
Well, and then keep in mind as you're going through, you know you have to come back out. So it's kind of a weird feeling even as you're getting through. But still phenomenal and just very empowering for me to be able to put myself in that wildly uncomfortable position and be able to push through. And knowing I was the first person on planet Earth in the history of the world to go through this little part
That's knowing that must feel so awesome.
It didn't go back very far, maybe a couple hundred feet in total. And in fact, I reached another point that I couldn't get through immediately. But once we got through, I had been keeping a caving journal the entire time, just for my own benefit for the future, so I could look back on it and remember the things I was experiencing. And when I got done, after we broke through, I thought, you know, I ought to put, rather than telling all my friends and family about the experience, I'll just get a little free website and put up the text of my caving journal. And then the idea popped into my head, it'd be kind of fun to embellish it a little bit. And then I thought, wait a minute, that would be really cool to embellish it. So I kind of, I don't remember giving it a lot of thought. It seemed like the whole story just kind of popped into existence in my mind on how it could play out. And I don't remember if I came up with that ending initially or if I had to work on that, but I thought, yeah, it would be fun to do it. And then I thought the medium would be fun to present it like I'm giving updates in real time. So all of the dates were the dates I actually posted that portion of the story. But going back a ways, once I decided to embellish it, came the task of writing the story. Oh my goodness.
Always the hardest part.
I enjoyed it, but it was a lot of work. And at some point after maybe 6-7 months, I thought, this is silly. No one's going to be interested in this. Why should I do it? And I think I sat on it for a month or two. And then I thought, all right, you know, at least finish. I mean, that's just in life, finish what you start. And then if something happens, good. If not, well, at least you finished it. You don't have open-ended projects. So it took about a year to get everything down to where I was happy with it. And then in April? I should have looked at the website. It's been a while. I think it was April of 2000 or 2001, because it took a year to write it. So April 2001 is when I started posting, and then every week or whatever, however often I did it, I would just do the updates until the end. And I had this wild fantasy that Art Bell was big at the time with his radio show about aliens and all kinds of weird things, ghosts. And I thought, it'd be so cool if he picked up on it or somebody told him about it, and everyone could be following along. And I didn't hear a thing from anyone the entire time.
We've all had that. Every writer I know has had that same fantasy in some form or another.
Exactly. Hoping for that wild success, knocking it out of the park. And it didn't happen. So I just kind of went on with my life. I was, again, satisfied that I finished a project that I set out to do, but that was about it. So that's how it came into existence.
All right. I had a similar thing, not nearly to the extent that Ted the Caver was, but I was keeping a journal for a while. This is when I must've been 13 at the time. And I had started getting into journaling, and it basically evolved or devolved, however you want to look at it, into like, oh, I'm writing about my day and this thing happened at school, but oh, what if actually this happened at school?
Nice.
And yeah, so I definitely get the impulse, the urge to want to embellish storytellers, man. So the when did which order do I want to go? When did the story really pick up steam? Because it wasn't instantaneous, like you were just saying.
Correct.
Eventually, it really exploded into this whole thing. When did you realize it was going to be Ted the Caver?
It was several years later. I had been monitoring the website. It was Angel Fire. It's still up. In fact, I was paying for a long time. I was paying to make it commercial free so nobody would have to deal with ads. But then I got tired of that. So now you have to deal with ads if you go to the site. But it is still up, which is kind of fun.
You've given us a lot over the years, Ted. We forgive you.
So I would check back on the site. I had a counter on the page. I had it hidden from view, but you could mouse over it and see. I thought if I put a counter on it, people might think. I still wanted people to think it was real, like, you know, and wonder, did this guy really get stuck in the cave or whatever? But I would just check back from time to time and look at the counter, and it was getting thousands of views over time. So I knew people were reading it, but I really had no idea how they were finding it, or I just didn't even think about that until 3 or 4 years later, I believe it was. I was contacted by a gal over in France, and she said she's a caver over there and she wanted to translate my story into French. And I thought that was way cool.
Yeah.
It was for her club, her grotto. So her caving club, which is a grotto. So I said, yeah, for sure. And then she is the one that let me know that there was a lot of discussion about the story on the Cavers website, the NSS, National Speleological Society. And that kind of blew me away that anyone even knew about it. I knew that people were reading it. So I logged on there, and there was debate about who wrote it. And I thought, well, that's kind of bizarre. My buddy Brad had told a few people about the project, so my name was out there in the caving community, but I didn't really think it went beyond that. But what threw a wrench in the whole discussion was somebody else was taking credit for it. And it's
despicable.
Is nuts. I just thought it was kind of funny. So I wanted to be anonymous completely, but once someone else was taking credit for it, I thought, well, I guess I need to come out and let the world know who I am. So I did. I made a post and gave enough evidence that if you were into caving, especially if you knew Brad or you were a local caver, that you would know it was me that wrote it. I also looked up the other guy's version of the story. I'm sure it's still available somewhere on the Wayback Machine or whatever.
It's like Jim the Spelunker.
Thomas Lyra is his name.
Oh, okay.
Who actually authored another book or two and was semi-well known in the caving community, which really mystified me why you would want to do that, first of all, and how you would think you could get away with it.
Yeah.
It's just so foreign to me.
People so, are audacious.
Yeah. So that weekend, I remember just going online and looking, doing all kinds of searches. Everyone was referring it to Ted the Caver. So I just did Google searches and just found tons and tons of forums where people were talking about it. And I was just grinning from ear to ear the whole time because I had no idea. And by the way, that brings up something that we did not talk about 5 years ago, is the name Ted the Caver. That did not come from me. That came from a website that a guy put up, and I don't remember the name of it. I should have looked that up beforehand. But he had the story, and he called it Ted the Caver. And I think that was what was driving most of the traffic to the Angel Fire site. He just had a link. He didn't post the story. He just posted a link. I tried to look him up, and it was a fake name. And when you see who owns the website, it was a fake name, and the address was the address of the Munsters, the old TV show. It was like Mockingbird Lane, 1313 yeah. Mockingbird Lane.
And the late 2000s internet was really something.
It's like, yeah, I really wanted to reach out and thank him for what he did for the story, because he gave it such a boost. But that's when I found out it was a lot more widespread than I knew about. And that's also when I found out, I think it was on the caving website, the NSS page, where someone was posting claiming to be a movie director and wanting to do a movie about the story, which I thought was nuts. I thought that was completely fake. You know, how could you make that into a movie? Not even thinking about many, many movies are made just from little short stories or whatever.
Oh, yeah.
So after a bit of time, after him trying to reach out and get in contact with me, I did a web search for his name, and I tracked down a website. It was like a church website, and this gal was saying that her and her husband, David Hunt, who was a movie director or getting ready to do his first movie, something to that effect, and they belonged to this church, and it said where she worked. So I Googled that name and number, not Google, whatever was around then, Yahoo. And I found her work name and number and called her and said, I apologize for this. This sounds weird, but is your husband doing a movie about a caver? And it was him. It was her. It was him. So I did get in touch with him finally, and we got all that worked out. And his concern about who wrote it was because he had signed a contract with Thomas Lyra to do the movie, which is, again, otherworldly nuts that
seriously
anyone could think they could get away with that. But
that's so, that's how bold and like, wow.
Yeah. Yeah. Don't really understand that mindset, but
yeah, like I can't imagine getting that far along with it. I, trying to claim responsibility alone is wild enough, but getting so like, and he could have just fessed up at any point. You had to know, he had to know he was going to get found out eventually. Like there's no way that he was like, I got this. Everyone buys it. I'm in the clear.
And right.
Yeah. I can't imagine that. Just the cognitive dissonance there is astounding.
Exactly. But so, at this point, it just makes another part of the fun story.
For sure, for sure. It's like, it's a very interesting part of the saga of the story. Yeah. So then there did eventually, a movie actually did come to pass, correct? And was that with David Hunt?
David Hunt, yeah. It took him a couple years, and that was, I think, his first full-length movie, and he's done a couple since. I've seen the one called Greater, which I don't know how widely released that was either, but that was, I saw it because of him. I knew him, so I
for sure.
See,
what were else you involved doing with the film at all, as far as the writing, the story, any aspect of it like that?
Nope, he had the script and everything all ready to go. He just needed to find out who I was so I could sign the contract. He didn't really need me with anything. I remember we did talk about one part of the story where Ted is going through the tight passage for the first time, and he just wanted to get some feedback from me about what that was really like. in real life. I don't know if it affected anything or if he talked to the actor about that, but phenomenal part of the movie, in my opinion. Oh my goodness. Yeah. So well done.
It's a Living Dark.
Living Dark, the story of Ted the Caver is the full.
That's right. Yeah. And was anything, for the people that haven't seen it, were there any major changes from the story to the film? I mean, with every adaptation, things have to be taken out and added in. But I guess any substantial changes that you found better or you found worse, anything like that? Not in a way to like trash the film or anything, but just.
Right. No, I was really happy. I was happy with what he put out, and I thought it was just a great story, a great adaptation. There had to be changes, so they were necessary. One thing he did was a conclusion, a hard ending, where you knew what happened. For the most part, there's a little bit of open-endedness to him that I think if he wanted to go back, he could make a sequel. For sure, but he did include a few lines directly from the story, but for the most part, it was his own work. But yeah, I was real happy with what he did. No,
that's
complaints.
Awesome. You hear so many people, writers, I guess in particular, who are just they have their work adapted and they hate what the filmmaker did with it. So it's always nice hearing that someone actually liked and enjoyed the adaptation of their work.
Including like Stephen King. I mean, he's been unhappy.
The Shining.
Exactly. That's what I was thinking of.
Yeah. Notoriously just loathed the Kubrick film. And which I get it. It's they are almost two completely different entities that happen to share a location and a handful of characters.
Yeah,
they're right, fundamentally right. different stories. But anyway, so to go back to something you mentioned just now and then a little bit earlier, going through that passage, you said you have a specific kind of claustrophobia, and I suspect it was actually going through that tiny, you know, the iconic Ted the Caver picture of you kind of,
yes,
you know, that one
picture. It's just for me, that size opening was tough where I couldn't move my arms. So I guess that how small the area is what determines the level of claustrophobia. But I mean, going in a cave is different. I mean, for human beings to be put in that position is weird anyways. So I get why you might be uncomfortable with that, but it's just, I was able to handle a bit more, but I did have to work up to it. It was, I've never been a fan of tight spaces. So, it took some mental effort.
Yeah. How tall are you, if you don't mind my asking? 6'5"?
6'5", but I'm pretty lean, so.
I'm also 6'5".
Oh, sweet.
Yeah. I was going to say, it's even worse for me, you know, cave claustrophobia things, but no, you get it, so it's not worse for me. A cat is biting me, sorry. So when you were writing it, because a substantial part of it was the actual caving journal, your documentation of what was actually happening. But then did you have any, because I know you said the actual writing portion, once you decided to kind of turn it into a semi-fiction thing, took a while. Were there any ideas you had that you were going to put in, but then kind of ended up not including? Did you ever have like a definitive ending in mind? Or was it always going to be the open-ended? And then we'll go with that. And then I have one other question kind of along those lines though. I'll wait to ask.
Okay. As far as the ending goes, no, that's my memory, is I always wanted to leave it like, what happened to Ted? There weren't anything, or there wasn't anything else that I remember that I wanted to include or didn't include and regret or anything like that. I think some of the things like the images on the wall, that might have been a product of just, I don't know, evolution of the story as it evolved. But that's about it. Most of it, I just kind of came up with. At least that's my memory of it.
No, I mean, that makes sense. Running and gunning is a perfectly legitimate form of writing. That's pretty much how I do it. I never outline. I just have kind of, I usually start, a story starts with like an opening image, and that'll either be the beginning or an image I have to work to, and then I just go from there. And so, the other question I had, as for what was in the cave, like the whatever thing lie within that cave system, did you ever have an image of what it was back there? What was making those noises? What was terrorizing these cavers?
I did not. I don't ever remember even thinking about what it might be. There's caving lore, the Hodag, the monster of the cave. Mm-hmm. So maybe I was just writing it off as a Hodag, but no, I never really cared what it was.
I like that. Ambiguity. I'm a big Lovecraft fan, and his fiction is all about, you know, the horror that you don't know, essentially. Fear of the unknown is scarier than anything else can possibly be. So I'm on board with that. The Hodag. I think the Hodag might be there's like these, I'm not going to say unofficial because it's not like there's official ones, but like the paranormal like entity of my state, I think, is the Hodag. I live in Wisconsin. And I feel like I might, I don't know. Like, you know how they have like state birds and state flowers? Right. I saw a list of like one of them is the Wendigo, one is Washington or Oregon is Bigfoot, like stuff like that. I think we're the Hodag. So,
nice.
Is there anything, if you could go back and change the story, would you change anything about it?
I would clean up a little bit of the writing. I think I, in retrospect, because I didn't have any writing experience, I still don't, but I would kind of dial back the foreshadowing a bit. I think I made it seem like it was more fiction, and my goal was to make it completely believable, like this is just really happening to me and my buddy. So I think I could have done a little better with that, but as far as elements of the story, no, I never really thought to change anything.
That's fair. I mean, like, honestly, I looked it up, and near as I can tell, as recently as last week, there's still people questioning, is Ted the Caver real, on the internet. So I don't think you did as poor a job as you think you did as making it believable. I myself 100% was on board with being like, this is proof that the paranormal exists.
Sweet. Something. I mean, something is there, which.
Yeah, because like, and I think we talked about this, you know, way back when, but like, you came out with that story, excuse me, at a time when internet horror essentially didn't exist, really, at least not in the form of the, you know, the creepypasta or the no sleep, the short stories, that sort of thing. And so, I mean, people were primed and ready to believe something like that because there weren't many examples of stories written in such a way and written in a realistic fashion for the sake of entertainment. Like there, and so I think you just came in at like, I mean, I guess really you could have come in at any time because you were the first one to do it on a scale that actually, you know, people recognized it or not recognized, but kind of saw it. It had visibility. And so, yeah, like that, it was just a perfect cocktail of timing, the writing, and just people's susceptibility that made it so widely believable. And that's just so cool.
And the pictures.
That too. I mean, that was huge.
When you're seeing it's very convincing. Yeah.
For sure. Exactly. I did a podcast, shout out to the Lovecraft E-Zine podcast, Mike Davis. They're awesome over there. Where we talked about just creepypastas in general. They had me on specifically to talk about internet horror, and I brought up your story and how it was, you know, the first of its kind. And we specifically talked about how the pictures lent it an authenticity that so many didn't have. So many, even following it, because a lot of stories, I mean, there are more Ted the Caver facsimiles, maybe that's not the right word I'm looking for, but I don't want to say copycats, but like a lot of stories borrowed the formula from Ted the Caver. And one thing that was always missing was either pictures that were very clearly photoshopped or no pictures at all. So yeah, having the actual genuine pictures from what is obviously a very real caving trip, like that was huge. That was instrumental to people believing that was real. And like, that was just genius.
Well, serendipitous maybe, but yeah, I mean, and the slow build and nothing unbelievable until the end of the story. So I thought that kind of lent to it, sucked you in basically.
Yeah, no, it definitely did. The because for I would say like 90% of it, it is all, and I don't mean this in a negative way, it's all pretty mundane, like
right, like this could happen. This,
yeah, this literally like happens. Yeah, and so yeah, it's really, it did a good job of like kind of priming you. And I'm speaking as a reader, I was ready for, I was so ready for something to happen and not it, like, cause you could, you know, you say you would have changed the foreshadowing, but in my memory of reading it that first time back when, you know, way back when, the foreshadowing worked on me, I suppose, because it was like, okay, something is clearly going on. There's something there. Tell me, please, Ted, tell me what's going on. And then when it finally happens, I'm like, oh my God, I can't, like, are these guys alive? They're not alive.
That's awesome. And again, I'd like to take credit for having planned all that out, but it's just happened.
It's just as cool that you didn't plan on it. It's just a different kind of cool.
and I think that might have helped too, just my ignorance and no writing experience. It does look a lot more raw and unpolished than Thomas Lyra's version, which is more like I'm reading this work of fiction, rather than this is some guy's caving journal. It's actual caving journal.
I personally can't think of another instance where a lack of writing experience has helped a story. Sweet. Again, such a unique trajectory for Ted the Caver. It's so cool. Have you ever considered doing more with the story, like turning it into a proper full-length novel or anything like that? Ever considered rewriting it?
Probably out of laziness or just a lack of desire to address it. I don't know. I've never really thought about adding to it. I believe we talked about last time we chatted that I did have the idea for a play, Ted the Caver, the play. And I still think it could work. I would have to get somebody involved that knew how to put on a play, but it maybe someday I'll put pen to paper and work out the details, but And it does sound fun too. It sounds like a fun challenge to be able to come up with something like that and make it good. But beyond that, I haven't thought to readdress Ted Rad.
For sure. And then the dog too. There was a dog that was present for the proceedings, was there not?
Yeah, I called it Whip. Spanky was his real name.
Oh, and
so Whip and Spank, I thought, were kind of some S&M themes.
It's so good. I love that.
Bizarre, but that little dog, oh my goodness, he was like Brad used to call him, a Jack Russell terrorist. Just an energetic little bugger. But yeah, it was fun to see that dog go in the cave too.
Yeah, and like again, not to like beat a dead horse or anything, but like having the incorporating the dog into the story like gives another thing for readers to latch onto. Like, oh, I have a dog, and if there was, this was going on, my dog would be freaking out about it too. Like, it adds just like a layer of authenticity. It's
awesome. Never really thought about that, but yeah, I like that.
I have thought about this story a lot over the years. As you can tell, so Ted the Caver blows up, a movie is made out of it. It, you know, launches this whole subculture of the horror genre. Hi, Diego. Yes, I hear you. I love you. Have you ever considered writing more? Have you ever written more? Because as far as I know, Ted the Caver is the only thing you've ever released.
Yeah, because of Ted the Caver, I was invited to write in a horror anthology called
Chilling Tales for Dark Nights.
Yeah. And so I put together a story. I came up with one, and we talked about that one, about the guy that was being chased by what he thought was a serial killer. And I was pretty happy with it, but it didn't really fit how they wanted the horror anthology to be. So they had I think several of us rewrite our stories. So I came up with a completely different one. And I was pretty happy with it too. There were a couple edits that didn't make it into the story that I don't remember why they didn't. So I was kind of disappointed in a couple things as far as the final product goes, but for the most part, I was pretty happy with that.
Yeah. Do you have any like aspirations to write anymore, or like, can I ask, like, is there like a reason why you don't write more, or is it just something you just happen to not have that like passion for?
Part of it is, I suppose, a lack of passion for it. I do get excited about, like I was excited about those stories, writing them. It's just kind of a fun challenge to come up with something. Maybe a little bit laziness, don't want to put forth the effort. Maybe a little bit don't have the ideas that I think would work. But then I see how long it took to write both of those stories and the Ted the Caver, and it's like it takes a lot of effort for me. Even nonfiction, I write blogs, disc golf related blogs, all the time for my work, but it's not real fast. And those are nonfiction; those are just based on, you know,
fact. Yeah. No, I get it. I'm trying to do this for a living, and I have that same laziness. It takes me forever to write anything. And so, yeah, no, for someone who doesn't have, and I do have that passion, like I love writing, I just can never do it. So I definitely get it.
How long does it take you to write a short story?
You know, back in the day when I really started writing, I could knock out a 3,000 word story in about 1,000 words an hour. So I would do, when I was real popular on No Sleep, I would post the first part of a series without having the second part written, knowing I had to post the second part the following day. So I would go to work, I would get home and I'd spend 3 to 5 hours writing a story, post it, boom, done. And I could do that. Now, I have written 4 short stories in the last 2 years. So whatever that averages out to. And it's not for lack of trying. I will say it's not entirely a lack of trying. I found other interests that have taken up my time. This podcast, for example, this is time I would normally spend writing. And then, you know, I grew up also, like I got a real big boy job and everything. So that takes a lot of the wind out of my sails. By the time I get home, I just want to sit down and not think.
Yeah.
So, you know, but you know, other writers do it every day. So like, I'm not trying to use all that as an excuse. It's, you know, whatever it is, but I go through these ebbs and flows of, I guess, motivation, inspiration, whatever you want to call it, ability. And right now I'm in a good one. I'm actually getting some words on the page. So that's nice. Definitely nice. Yeah.
It does take effort. I mean.
Yeah. Yeah. It's. Yeah. I could go on and on about this. People have heard me talk enough. What do you do other than, you know, who is Ted? Who is the man behind the myth?
I was into caving heavy back when I wrote that story. And then I don't know why, I just started doing it less and less and took up mountain biking. That was an addiction for a long time. But when we moved up to where I currently live in Cache Valley, Utah, there aren't any convenient places to ride without throwing your bike in your truck and driving somewhere. So I got into disc golf. So that's now what I do for a hobby and pretty much my life, my job.
That's awesome. I have only played a handful of times and it is so much more difficult than it looks. And I've also been, I'm getting into this, like, I guess class of videos on YouTube of like ultimate frisbee.
And oh yeah.
I know it's, you know, different from disc golf and everything, but it is crazy how intense that all gets.
Yes, they are very athletic and it's entertaining to watch and just fast paced.
Yeah. And it's and like one of those things
I do that. If I were younger, I would do that instead of disc golf, but I like the pace of disc golf right now.
Yeah, for sure. Oh, one thing I wanted to ask you about, and sorry, this is, I know we just kind of shifted over to personal rather than writing, but what is your relationship to just the horror genre in general? Have you always been a fan of it? Like, what kind of horror do you like, if any at all, you know?
I'm not a big fan of creepypastas or horror fiction for the most part. Movies, I have a love-hate relationship with. When I hear a good scary movie comes out that people are raving about, I have to go see it, and then the whole time I'm there, I'm thinking, why am I here? But then I go back and do it again the next time a good one comes out. So,
of course.
I don't know what that is, but I just enjoy a good movie that can really engage me. Horror is my favorite genre, but as far as horror movies go, it's, yeah, love, hate.
Yeah. Do you have a favorite that you can point to, or one that kind of especially colored your opinion of the genre?
I just saw an ad for a movie I saw about 5 years ago, 5 or 6, called Us.
Yes, I love Us.
And I just remember thinking, this is good and scary and weird, and I really liked it. That first Saw movie, this is going way, way back, but that was a good one too.
That's such an interesting one because I feel like in people's minds, it is so much more bloody, gory of a movie than it actually is. It is not all that bloody and gory.
A lot of psychological horror.
Yeah.
It's really good. I don't know that carried through the whole series, but
it certainly did not.
I've only seen a couple of them, but
I unfortunately have seen them all. And it's the first three, I will give it to the first three. They are solid. They are well-told films. But even starting with the second, it really starts leaning into the gratuitous nature of what the first one could have been, but kept restrained. And, oh my God, my cat. Come on, man. And, but as it goes further and further on, it just gets more and more. Oh my goodness. Okay. I'm sorry, Ted. This is Diego. Oh my goodness. Ow. This is great podcasting right now, huh?
The cat is not declawed.
You know he's not. Oh, this hurts so bad. Oh, that was fun. I'm glad you had a good time. Go. Sorry about that, Ted. Jesus.
Had to make an appearance.
Yeah, he did. He's the most lovable cat in the world. Are you a cat guy, dog guy, any pets of your own?
I like dogs.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't have one, but I like a good dog, a good friendly dog.
Yeah. A good whip or a spanky. Yeah. But yeah, no, I really appreciate you taking the time to talk with me again, Ted. This was a lot of fun.
Yeah. I enjoy it.
I have upgraded my, I won't call it a studio really yet, but I feel that, you know, you were the very first person I ever interviewed.
Ooh.
Ever. Yeah, right? Like, this is a fun, you're coming up on the 25-year anniversary of Ted the Caver. And I'm coming up on the 5-year anniversary of speaking with you. So I appreciate it, man.
Right on. You're welcome. It was fun.
Yes, sir. All right. You have a good one, Ted.
All right. Take care, Nick.